If he came sniffing around, I planned to tell him that the West Wing pooper was now wreaking havoc in the EEOB. Maybe he should go check it out. We laid the groundwork weeks in advance. Stephanie was still living in Philly, where she worked for Fuji Bikes. So we switched on and off taking Amtrak or making the drive along I-95. I told Stephanie that the communication shop was hosting a spring party at the White House on Friday, April 6th, so she would need to be in D.C. that weekend. I suggested she wear something nice, that she looked good, which she didn't take quite as well as I'd hoped. I looped around an email with Marie to talk through what each was planning to wear to the party. It was a long con. The most consequential trick I had previously played on Stephanie was in college, when my roommate Chris and I said we would cook dinner. Instead, we bought Taco Bell, repackaged it nicely on gourmet plates, poured the Mountain Dew Baja Blast into an elegant pitcher, and sat down to eat. An unwitting Stephanie was then forced to admit that she did not, in fact, hate Taco Bell, as she so often claimed. The stakes were higher for this sham. As Friday neared, my nerves increased, and by the morning of the proposal, jitters were jumping through me so much so that I couldn't sleep. I arrived at work earlier than normal. By early afternoon, Jay couldn't help himself. He approached my desk, and I knew what was coming. I know, I said, preempting him. Bashar al-Assad, yada, yada, yada. No, Jay said. I just heard today's the big day, and I wanted to say, oh, thank you, I said, feeling like an idiot. No, I gotta say, you don't look great. Huh? I didn't sleep much, I protested. You should really go home and shave. And so I did. I walked briskly up 16th Street to the filthy studio apartment I was renting. Stephanie arrived early from Philadelphia as I was getting out of the shower, so I hid the ring box in my hanging sock cubby just before she walked in. My plan was to stay with Stephanie and walk back to the White House together. Then I received an email from Marie. The subject line began, "Don't freak out, but..." I was absolutely freaking out. Marie explained that the president's schedule was shifting. We might miss our window and lose the light. I didn't have a backup plan. Hadn't considered that something might not work out. I had gotten a bit too comfortable in the environment. A slow Friday could feel a bit like a flop house, like any office counting the minutes until happy hour. I neglected to consider, as I had learned time and again, that the tenor of the place can change in an instant, with fun plans scuttled just as quickly. To compound things, both my family and Stephanie's family were waiting at a nearby hotel to celebrate our rose garden engagement. They had come from across the country to be there. I shaved quickly, rustled through my socks and grabbed the ring, told Stephanie the party was delayed slightly due to a minor work emergency, and rushed back to the office. The Oval Office looks squarely into the Rose Garden. Often, when the sun has only recently disappeared beyond the monuments in the mall, the oval remains alight, and the room's glow seeps through its sizable windows, partly illuminating the colonnade and the Rose Garden, but not enough for my plan to work. I couldn't let it get to that point. The pictures wouldn't turn out well. A Secret Service agent stands guard along the colonnade whenever the president is in the oval. I checked as soon as I arrived. The agent was there, but the Rose Garden was still bright. I consulted the president's private schedule again. He was supposed to be finished for the day. What could possibly be keeping the leader of the free world at work late on a Friday night? I asked Marie and Antoinette, irrationally frustrated. Calm down, patty cakes, they told me. It's going to work out. I took a seat at my desk in upper press to try to do just that. But then coworkers who had heard the news started coming out of the woodwork, popping in from all corners of the West Wing. Jay walked in with Gene Sperling, one of the president's top economic advisors, and explained what I was about to do. Now, I hadn't previously worked at all with Gene, known around the West Wing as the Gene Machine, but he piped right up. "Can I offer you some advice?" he asked. "Please." "She might say no." "That's advice." "Hey, I'm in politics," the Gene Machine reasoned. "It's all about expectation setting." I couldn't sit around any longer. Time to get things in motion. I took a flyer and, with time winding down, sent Stephanie a note to head toward the White House. I promised I would meet her at the Northwest Gate in front of Lafayette Park. As she made her way down 16th Street, the president, mercifully, crossed from the Oval, down the colonnade, through the Palm Room, and up to the residence. Relieved, we took our positions. Marie dashed through the briefing room to grab Evan, a photographer from the Associated Press who'd agreed to surreptitiously photograph our engagement. Antoinette jogged out to the gate to meet Stephanie, and I took up a spot on the colonnade. It was then that I realized, for all the crap they were giving me, much of the West Wing had stayed late on an otherwise slow Friday to help out. Ben Rhodes, a deputy national security advisor with many more important things on his mind, volunteered to block the double doors to the colonnade so that no one would interrupt our moment. Stephanie told me later that she was annoyed with me for abandoning her at her apartment and doubly perturbed when I was nowhere to be found at the White House. She was mystified when Antoinette grabbed her from the gate, insisting on removing her security badge and taking her purse. But then Antoinette pushed her out to the Rose Garden. I was waiting on the colonnade. Truth is, I don't remember much more after this. I took her hand and walked her through a small clearing in the bushes toward the center of the Rose Garden. I spoke for what seemed like an eternity, in varying degrees of coherence, and then took a knee. I remember hearing the familiar click of a camera, but didn't know where it was coming from. Stephanie doesn't remember what she said either, but she was nodding her head over and over, which had to mean something good. She said yes. We walked back to the colonnade and down to the palm room. I saw Marie and Evan the photographer jump from the bushes to the palm room to capture more moments. When we got to the palm room, we celebrated. "This was my favorite wrangling job yet," Marie exclaimed. My family was waiting for us at the hotel, but as Stephanie and I stepped down into lower press, where everybody was waiting, Matt, Bobby, Hallie, and others, I realized that I was developing another family, an Obama family, and I didn't want any of this to end. Even in the afterglow of our engagement, as the White House felt more like a second home than an office, and just when I was finally getting the hang of things, polls and bumper stickers, attack ads and obnoxious buttons were constant reminders that it could all come crumbling down on Tuesday, November 6, 2012. Even while Obama seemed to command a comfortable lead, Dan, Jay, Hallie, and others, all more experienced political hands than I was, warned me not to worry too much when things tightened. The gap between the two candidates would inevitably and naturally begin to close. After all, gaffes would be made. Many of the all-important undecideds would soon decide to come home and vote the way they usually did. Most of all, a close race, or the perception of a close race, benefits the media. So it would have to be. For months, the Obama campaign had capitalized on Romney's proclivity for goofy gaffes, foremost among them his attempts at appealing to middle America by talking about how some of his friends own NASCAR teams, as well as his caught-on-audio comments about nearly half the country. All right, there are 47% who are with him, him being Obama, who are dependent upon government, who believe that they are victims, who believe the government has a responsibility to care for them, who believe that they are entitled to health care, to food, to housing, to you name it. My job is not to worry about those people. I'll never convince them they should take personal responsibility and care for their lives. Now, that was a doozy, damaging in the way that the worst gaffes so often are. They provide seeming proof of a notion that many voters already have about a candidate. In this case, that Mitt Romney is rich and out of touch. And they can be boiled down into a quick turn of phrase, rebutting the candidate. I am the 47%. Obama slipped up and flubbed a line that fit all the same criteria. Campaigning in Roanoke, Virginia, as he was speaking about the unique opportunities our country and way of government has provided for its citizens, Obama told a hypothetical entrepreneur, in reference to his hypothetical business, "You didn't build that." You didn't build that. I knew the second he said it. It didn't sit well. Sure, I understood what he was going for, that the hypothetical entrepreneur no doubt benefited from America's infrastructure or technological advances from the military or any number of other benefits of living in the land of the free. But it didn't ring right rhetorically, and the Republicans seized the opportunity. I did build that. The gaffes both candidates made during the summer of 2012 seem quaint when considered through the looking glass of the election that would follow, but on the trail, they haunted us into the fall. Tension ratcheted up as the first presidential debate loomed in early October. Still, as I pulled into debate prep in Henderson, Nevada, I felt fine, buoyed by a 7-point lead in the polls and ready to spend some time at the pool, rather than with the pool. Meanwhile, the president and his team, with Senator John Kerry of Massachusetts playing Mitt Romney, ran through mock debates on a stage nearly identical to the one that waited in Denver. It's common practice to prepare for presidential debates secluded from the distractions of D.C. in a retreat-like setting. So our motorcade snaked along the highways of Henderson as always. But things took a turn, literally and figuratively. As we approached our hotel, with 500 rooms, about 20 miles outside of Las Vegas. As we advanced, something was becoming abundantly clear. We were entering the hotel equivalent of a ghost town, a one-time luxury resort with no guests, no hubbub, nobody lining the streets looking at us, zero signs waving, no clapping from supporters, and no middle fingers raised by detractors. There was another way folks along the motorcade route expressed their displeasure with the president that was actually more offensive than the middle fingers. They would dramatically turn their backs on the motorcade as it passed. It was a particularly effective form of silent protest in that it really caught our attention. It irritated me every time. And yet, it was also wonderfully American to openly gripe about your leader, even in his presence. The kind of action that helped make America great in the first place. I got the sense that those middle fingers and turned backs didn't bother President Obama quite so much as they did me. But there was no one to turn their backs on us as we continued along the vacant hotel grounds, driving through an overgrown, grotesquely unused golf course, and passing a vacant high-end shopping center constructed with man-made water features to look like it sat on a quaint river bluff in Europe. The ride was eerie, like Disney World the day after the apocalypse. I sent Maria a text. This place is odd, right? She filled me in on some of the details. Turns out the resort defaulted on its mortgage during the economic crisis of 2008 and 2009, which hit Las Vegas and its surrounding cities particularly hard. The city was coming back, but not as quickly as most would like. Insofar as the 2012 election, like all elections, was about the economy, stupid, and a referendum on whether the president had done enough to jumpstart our economy, Henderson was a troubling spot to choose for the president to hone his argument for the American people about why his vision for economic growth continued to be the best one. It was the ideal dateline for a snarky think piece waiting to be written by one of the slightly bored journalists hanging around the hotel pool with me as the president worked diligently behind closed doors on his economic talking points. We would have 3 days here. 3 days for Obama to refine the rhetoric, adjust the arguments, memorize the statistics, and practice a punchy line or two, before stepping in front of 70 million Americans, plus the dulcet-toned Jim Lehrer, the recently retired PBS NewsHour anchorman, and the man who had been campaigning for months to put the president and all of us out of work. 3 days before America really started to pay attention. Do we want to keep this guy or try something new? It's a truism that most incumbents lose the first debate. Thing is, nobody told me that. So by the time our 3 days in Henderson were up, I was optimistic, confident as we landed in Denver, excited as we rolled down the cleared-out highway, that my boss would wipe the floor with Romney. There were omens, though, that suggested we might be in for a surprise. First, our motorcade driver was nuts. The motorcade becomes so unwieldy in its length when traveling outside of D.C. with the president that we often rely on volunteers to drive many of the vans toward the back of the convoy. The driver assigned to the press van I was fortunate enough to ride shotgun in, bless her, did not understand the basic concept of the motorcade, the idea that, above all, we must stay together. Now, these drivers are not pulled off the street and thrown keys. They are instructed exactly how to drive. We have an advanced staffer fully dedicated to the motorcade, and I do mean dedicated. One of my favorite advanced staffers, Tim Sneed, had developed a bit of roadshow glory, known for his cowboy hat and the moniker Tim Sneed Motorcade, which was how most people referred to him. He packed dozens of Matchbox cars for every trip to simulate a miniature motorcade. There's a very distinct order into which the motorcade's vehicles are arranged. Absent a breakdown, there's no passing in motorcades, so the convoy is only as strong as its weakest rental van. In Denver, mine was the weakest link. We were delaying the cars behind us. I didn't want to be a backseat driver, but we were threatening to chop the motorcade in two. You should really keep a little closer to the car in front. From that moment on, she overcorrected, and every time the string of vehicles tautened, we'd nearly slam into the van ahead. "Brake!" I'd yell. The reporters' cameras and laptops would go flying forward. Eventually, I had to stop looking at the cars ahead. It was too nerve-wracking. So I focused on the billboards that went whizzing by until a striking advertisement loomed in the distance and grew larger as our driver lurched us forward. A darkened photo of a dour-looking Obama came into focus, shouting down at all of these swing state passers-by trying to get to work, "You didn't build that!" I nearly refound religion on that ride. A photographer or two kissed the pavement when we pulled up to our destination. But we need more than faith for what would come next. We knew we had lost the debate within the first 10 minutes. Twitter said so. But I didn't need them to tell us. Truth is, my gut had dropped by the end of the 2-minute opening statements. Each candidate had made a joke about it being President and Mrs. Obama's anniversary. But Romney's landed better. He actually got the bigger laugh. It was a precursor. His lines would resonate with the room all night. Obama seemed listless, whereas Romney came to play, finally on equal footing with the president. He looked the part. I had never been to a debate before and didn't really know how to watch one, so I took it in like a Philly sports fan. We'll come back, I kept telling myself. This is our year. He's got to win. He didn't win. Let's get the hell out of here. Like two grousing Phillies fans trying to beat traffic, my coworker Nick and I darted out of the spin room. There was no spinning this in my mind, and dashed into a waiting car, where a Democratic volunteer would take us back to the hotel. What happened in there? The driver asked. Nothing good. Marie, on the other hand, was with the pool, rushing from the arena back to the vans. They all piled into the motorcade, where their volunteer driver had a different take. Wow, he was great tonight. It's easy to be blinded by partisanship, but this was such a decisive loss that even my Nana was momentarily disappointed in her Barack. Still, Marie ran with it, nodding along in disbelief until the driver piled on, mentioning how proud she was of Mitt. Marie turned around to the reporters, filling the three rows behind her, and shared a moment of panic. Run, Marie shouted. They were unwittingly behind enemy lines. Wrong motorcade. They swung open the doors, sprinted down the road, and barely caught up to the correct motorcade, where their driver, an Obama volunteer, was waiting nervously. She had been worried that the president's debate performance was so bad that everybody had jumped ship and literally climbed aboard the Romney bandwagon, leaving her van empty. On Election Day 2012, our motorcade was a bit different. Rather than the bland vans to which we had become accustomed, our advance staffer Jeff hooked us up with a party bus that was more suitable for a bachelor party than a presidential motorcade. There was booze, swanky leather chairs lining the walls, and decorative lighting, as well as an impressive sound system and a mirrored ceiling. Marie, the pool, and I were grateful for Jeff's creativity. We would be in the van for many hours on November 6, 2012. Election days are about active waiting. The party bus was a nice place to do it. Obama had bounced back after the first debate knockout, and our side had finally begun to rationalize the subpar performance. Much of Democratic Twitter had melted down at first. In fact, Andrew Sullivan's take was so bleak that Dan put a moratorium on our media monitor, Vels at the time, sending around the Newsweek Daily Beast writers increasingly terrible analyses. Obama's pre-debate polling edge had been chopped in half, but we were still up, and our path to 270 electoral votes was much more clear than Romney's. The polls would need to be overwhelmingly wrong for things to go against us, and we had no reason not to trust the polls. So things looked good as we boarded the party bus, escaping the early morning Chicago chill outside of President Obama's family home. We'd been up since before dawn and didn't expect to sleep again until the next day. The long nights, 10-day travel stretches, the debates and commercials, the OTRs, bus tours, and slogans had all led to this day. America was voting. While we waited, we popped into a local campaign office for some phone banking. The president, in shirt sleeves and black and gray striped tie, took to the phones, greeting breathless volunteers and chatting on the phone, when they didn't ignore the call, with Chicago area voters. Beyond that, we mainly waited. We asked, "What have you heard?" Nobody had heard anything. We wondered, "How are you feeling?" Everybody felt the same, nervous. As the sun went down, the stakes went up. Returns rushed in. I met Bobby, who took a few days off from the White House to volunteer for the final days of the campaign in Chicago. On election day, his primary task was finding the pool dinner, making him the most overqualified pizza boy on the planet. I met him to help carry the boxes, but when we arrived at the pizza shop, it was closed. The pool was hungry, and it was beginning to rain. Jeff had a backup plan and had food delivered directly to our bus. As we got back, damp from the deluge, word came down that the numbers looked good. Jeff, Marie, and I celebrated. Then my mom called. She won her first re-election to the Pennsylvania State House. One more thing to celebrate. As the night wore on, and the numbers continued to add up to what we thought would be a big win, the motorcade made its way to McCormick Place, the largest convention center in North America, and the site of the re-election speech, as well as what seemed like the biggest party North America had ever seen. Music blared. We kept our eyes glued to our Blackberries. When would they call the election? Just before 10:15 local Chicago time, it happened. The election was called for President Obama. We had a party on the party bus, and waited some more. The president couldn't speak until after Romney had called and conceded. Jon Favreau sent the text of the re-election victory speech, with a fitting, all-caps subject line. Eventually, we rushed into McCormick Place like we had so many times in so many places before, snaking backstage, beyond the drapes and into the event site, where we were met by massive blue drapes, countless waving American flags, and the most overjoyed, optimistic people you could cram into a convention center. The president took to the stage with his family as Stevie Wonder's celebratory signed, sealed, delivered, I'm yours, blared. As his family dispersed to cheers and Stevie's last refrain concluded, the crowd erupted, chanting 4 more years, so powerfully that the president needed to delay his start. The crowd was in control, until Obama took over. Tonight, more than 200 years after a former colony won the right to determine its own destiny, the task of perfecting our union moves forward. It moves forward because of you. I turned around in the buffer, looked out at the sea of people behind me and thought back to 4 years before, a world away, watching a similar scene from the Atlantic Ocean. I knew the president meant what he said. Everyone, staffers, volunteers, voters, had a say in moving America forward. For the United States of America, the best is yet to come. No matter what you do or where you go from here, you will carry the memory of the history we made together. I didn't know what was next for me or where I'd wind up following life on the campaign trail, but I knew he was right. I would never forget this moment when politics seemed so big. The arguments we had are a mark of our liberty, the president continued. Progress will come in fits and starts. It's not always a straight line. It's not always a smooth path. That much, as we would learn firsthand, was all too true. But there was no time to worry over that. We were focused on, as President Obama said, what makes America great. I have never been more hopeful about our future. I have never been more hopeful about America. And I ask you to sustain that hope. His wasn't a call for blind optimism. It was a belief in that stubborn thing inside of us that insists, despite all evidence to the contrary, that something better awaits us so long as we have the courage to keep reaching, to keep working, to keep fighting. And just like that, he was finished. The campaign was officially over, and confetti rained down. Backstage, Marie, Jeff, and I bumped into the president and first lady after the speech. He gave me a hug. I worried for an instant that maybe none of this was real. It was all going too well. But then the first lady came up to me and sort of shimmied to the music, and I didn't know whether to sort of shimmy back. And so I just stood there like a moron, and I felt super awkward, which is when I knew it wasn't a dream. This was real life, though not the life I could have envisioned 4 years prior, and a world away, looking out with Stephanie over the vast blue Atlantic. The blue room of the White House is, well, blue. Sandwiched between the equally aptly named red and green rooms, the blue room was known best by members of our White House staff as the spot with the largest Christmas tree come December. During the marathon of holiday receptions, it was the place to meet on the crowded state floor for some of the White House's infamous boozy eggnog, which was made by melting ice cream before pouring in too many types of alcohol to list. It was known to get the better of guests and staffers alike. We planned to use the blue room for a slightly more presidential purpose on January 20th, 2013. Tradition holds that if the new president's swearing-in falls on a Sunday, it is to be handled as a small, private ceremony. The spectacle of the public inauguration is meant to follow the next day, Monday. Marie, Antoinette, Brian, and I had been working on the logistics for weeks. The oath-taking would require only moments, but the timing had to be right. The U.S. Constitution dictates it. More importantly for our purposes, the TV executives demand it. Every network planned to break into its special programming and take the oath live. We had to hit the mark. For these most sensitive events and big moments, we brought in an atomic clock. Sturdy with red digital numbers blinking the time, atomic clocks are the most accurate timekeepers in existence, some with an uncertainty of just 1 second in 30 million years. That made us more comfortable. We knew that if our timing was off, then the schedules for the military's global positioning systems were wrong too. I'm not sure why that made us feel better, but it did. Something about 30 million years and being in this together. So we liked our chances of hitting the mark at 11:55, 5 minutes prior to the Constitution's noon deadline. The Friday before inauguration weekend, we got word that the president wanted to do a practice run. Stephanie and I hadn't noticed this on our Atlantic Ocean feed 4 years before, but I learned later that Chief Justice Roberts had fumbled the oath at Barack Obama's first inauguration. In fact, he had to visit the White House the next day for a do-over in the map room, just to be sure America's president was, in fact, president. We wanted to guard against similar problems the second time around. The first lady couldn't make it to the practice run, so we needed a stand-in. Somebody chose Marie. Now we just needed a book. I had a copy of the comedian Sinbad's 1998 bestseller, Sinbad's Guide to Life, Because I Know Everything, on my desk. Our go-getter of an intern, Michael, had just submitted an impressive book report to me on what he'd learned from the book. Even though it might have been my Bible, Sinbad's smash paperback was too thin to be a credible replacement for the real deal. So Marie ran down to Lower Press and grabbed a more substantial stand-in, snatching the first of two books she spotted resting against the base of her desk. Then she ran upstairs to the blue room to pretend to be the First Lady. As our pretend Chief Justice got underway, she held out the book for the President to rest his hand. He gave her a quizzical look. Marie gasped. Had she accidentally grabbed 50 Shades of Grey? Life of Pi, Obama asked. He placed his hand on the cover and, before getting on with the practice run, gave his approval. Good book. Friday's rehearsal was a success. We spent most of Sunday morning prepping the blue room. The camera crew set up gear and then did final sound and lighting checks. The resident staff removed the marble-topped wooden table in the center of the room. Marie and I waited, worried, and wondered how it would all play out. We answered the same questions over and over. Yes, we're still on time. Yep, the whole First Family will still stand with them. As the clock hit 11:30, the room began to fill. The pool was in place, and a few lucky members of the president's extended family filtered in. There were just a few staffers in the room. Marie and I eagerly anticipated the official start to the second term. At 11:53, I gave a 2-minute warning to the producer standing next to me. I triple-checked that my phone was muted. It was. Remembering that it had gone off the week before, interrupting our meeting in the Roosevelt Room, I quadruple-checked. I didn't think the lighthearted, ineffectual whimsy of the Curb Your Enthusiasm theme song would play well over the president's oath of office. 2 minutes later, the president hit his mark. The oath went off without a hitch, and Barack Obama's second term officially began. It was difficult to wrap my head around the idea that I was in the room, a few paces away, on the periphery of history. I did my best to take it in, to not let it slip by for granted, to stretch it out as long as I could. I knew firsthand what this moment in the blue room meant to folks a world away. Chapter 5, Office Politics. I padded the book immensely. I probably would eliminate Chapter 5 and gone straight to 6. I wrote it because you have to have 5 to get to 6. Sinbad, in the 1995 film Houseguest. After the election, things around the West Wing fell into a familiar rhythm. They went back to normal, at least as normal as the White House allows, and presidential politics gave way to office politics. Before the White House, it hadn't occurred to me that there were so many ways to read, or write, an email that said the same thing. Consider a quick note of gratitude. Thank you! Exclamation point in your inbox is a good thing. Thanks very much is a very good thing. Thank you is genuine. Thanks is fine and likely well-intentioned too. TY and THX are more inscrutable. But around the West Wing, throw a period at the end of the shorter thanks and some introspection is in order. Thanks. Maybe you were late getting your coworker what he needed, or the news is not as she'd hoped. Perhaps your colleague isn't feeling well, or the Navy mess burned his English muffin. It's also possible that whoever is writing thanks with a period just doesn't like you. It's all part of the language, the nuance of the place. In that way, I suppose the White House is like any office. Cliques formed, rivalries developed, people read too much into the meaning of otherwise straightforward emails. We sometimes pawned off work or passed the buck. We dealt with the boss's pets. We tried to raise our profiles at work, speaking up and offering insights in front of the chief of staff or finagling an invite to a senior staff meeting, taking on an additional task or two. But we in the press office had the unique opportunity to raise our profiles beyond the office and out in the world as well, to build our brand. Playbook, Politico's pervasive morning tip sheet, which was emailed to everybody inside the Beltway before sunrise, was a good way to start. Did your birthday make Playbook? If so, was it in the headline or just the body? These were some of the gross questions upon which D.C. social life, which exists only as a function of D.C. work life, is built. Somehow, attention from hometown papers seemed of a different, less gross sort. A variation on local kid hits it big in the White House was a common headline written about everybody, from the Media Monitor to major administration players in papers from Arkansas to Alaska. We all came from somewhere. Everybody had a story to tell. Some were no-brainers. Some were a stretch. Schultz had a knack for the art of the stretch. I remember one day he had been lingering around Upper Press, something clearly on his mind. And I knew that if he wasn't spinning a story in service of the president, he was surely working an angle at self-promotion. So this had to be good, fruitful ground for mocking. Josh was by now the press secretary. Same great hair and clean jokes, just with a bigger office and a bit of fame even beyond the beltway. Josh, Schultz called, sensing an opening as Josh departed his office. Do you have any flags with me placing Louis in Doggy Du Jour magazine? It's for their Washington Power Player Pets edition. This gave new meaning to the term pet project, I thought. Would you be in the article too? Josh asked. Schultz gave him a look that indicated the whole point was so that he would be included. He was the power player in this equation, after all. He produced the outlet's metrics, inexplicably had them at the ready. Circulation of 230,000, and 3 million online subscribers. I definitely think you need to do this. It would be nice for Louis, Josh offered generously. Totes, Schultz said with his signature swivel, smile, and quick watch check. Self-promotion didn't always run like clockwork, though. In fact, the Hill's infamous 50 Most Beautiful list could get downright ugly. Nominations poured in anonymously to The Hill, one of DC's most popular publications. And each spring, it was time to whittle down the 50 best-looking people in the city to be named and profiled in the summer for The Hill's yearly exercise in self-aware superficiality. Staffers began jockeying for position. Feelings could be hurt and egos bruised. It was a nasty process, and I was in charge of it when I wasn't tied up with stories about White House varmints. Although you could say I was dealing with a different sort of White House fox. It was up to me, when nominations for White House staffers came in, to send each nominee a note that somebody thought they were hot and had submitted them for consideration. The height of awkward. Are you willing to participate? To get your photo taken? Oh, and by the way, The Hill will judge, based on your photos, whether you actually make the cut. They hesitated, but most who were nominated took part. Still, the process was better than I thought initially. The first time I was put in charge of the story, a coworker and I were under the impression that it was our duty to determine who among our coworkers were the most handsome and most beautiful, and to report back to The Hill with options. Now that was an uncomfortable brainstorming session. Eventually, we took our list of comely coworkers to Josh. Somewhat aghast, he said that it wasn't the White House's responsibility to choose who should go on that list. Instead, like the holiday receptions, we just managed those who had been tapped to participate. I recognized immediately the error of our ways, but looking at Josh, I couldn't help noticing his rolling brown locks. That hair, I thought. What an oversight. In truth, I didn't need to worry about making nominations, because folks were more than willing to do that for themselves. I had to flag for a coworker that he was trending on a popular gossip website because his interns had been misusing official resources, busily sending out solicitations via prominent White House email lists, asking hundreds of friends of the administration, many of them quite high profile, to vote for him. It was not a good look, but I was pleased that my intern's Sinbad book report had now been supplanted as the least productive use of a White House intern's time since the Clinton years. Still, I wasn't innocent in all of this. I did my fair share of self-promotion. I had my wedding announcement in the New York Times and looked for my name in Playbook many mornings. I even asked, okay, pleaded with, Keith, a regional spokesperson in charge of press in the Northeast, to pitch me to the Philadelphia Inquirer. No dice on the Inquirer. But I did, in my final year, take part in the 50 Most Beautiful list. I did not crack the top 10. Like many offices, we obsessed over lunch. Wondered how early was too early to start asking about plans or what was on the mess menu. The White House mess is a West Wing mainstay, a focal point for countless discussions and rendezvous, as well as a source of much aggravation. Staffers called down from their desks and placed an order for pickup one level below. They didn't do delivery for anyone not named Barack or Joe. The mess is located in the basement of the West Wing. A quick trip down the stairs at the entrance to Upper Press, past the chief speechwriter's office, and the suite of national security offices and cubicles just beyond Pete Souza's nook, which used to be the White House barbershop, you turn down a narrow, nautically themed hallway toward our collective watering hole. There's the formal dining area for special guests and senior staff that I mentioned with regards to the UK state dinner, but the real mess is the pickup window, flanked by two TVs, one set to ESPN and the other to the news. A line forms down the hall to the small window. Thursdays served as Mexican Day, which always prompted a longer-than-usual line, because the reliably wonderful chips and queso were a real crowd-pleaser. Most Mexican days, to ensure I got a hot batch of queso, I'd monitor the bottom right corner of my computer screen. The earliest you could call for lunch was 11:30, so at 11:28, 11:29, I would ready my hand at the phone, eager to dial the number I knew by heart, 71535. The mess would occasionally bring in celebrity guest chefs, from Jose Andres to Guy Fieri, to cook us some of their favorites. It was a highlight, usually months in the making. Thing is, on the mornings of, I had a tendency to forget about the guest chef. As I would announce to my coworkers in upper press that I was headed to Subway for a crummy sandwich, Vels and Desiree would snicker but fail to save me from myself. "Enjoy your $5 footlong," they'd crack. Most of the time, it was just as well. Celebrity guests generated the longest lines of all. Sometimes they meandered up the nautical hall and back down the corner towards Pete's office. As you slogged closer to the pickup window, about three customers out, if you glanced to your right, you would find, no more than 6 feet away, an understated brown door with an oval gold placard. This was the entrance to the White House Situation Room. This was an area of great stress. Options were presented quickly. Like so many decisions at the White House, sometimes the only choices were bad or worse. And I'm sure it wasn't so easy in the Situation Room either. It always made me laugh. White House staffers and guests sloshing about the mess with their coffees and cokes, while on the other side of the door to the Situation Room, really a suite of smaller Situation Rooms, life and death decisions were constantly on the docket. I remember well the morning when Jimmy, breathless, approached the new guy at the mess. "This is the third time I've had eggs this week, and they're always runny, and I asked for hard eggs, and how hard is it to make hard eggs, because I don't like runny eggs, and please just make me some new eggs." By the end, his voice was so high that his words were hitting a register almost imperceptible to the human ear. Vels watched the debacle unfold and asked what was the matter. Jimmy repeated his concerns verbatim, only quicker, and now at a pitch only dogs can hear. "This ain't Chuck E. Cheese's, people," Vels would say. "This is the White House." His familiar refrain was a way of saying that everybody should be at the top of his or her game in the West Wing. Runny eggs simply would not do. Truth is, the mess and those who worked in it helped make the West Wing work. They were a huge part of life at the White House. We shouldn't have complained, but like any office cafeteria, it got to a point where they were an easy target, a punching bag in an extremely stressful environment where it wasn't okay to complain about how hard our jobs were. So moaning about the mess provided momentary relief. Accordingly, Jimmy and Vels weren't wrong. They were speaking for hundreds of staffers, giving voice to those whose frustrations would have gone unspoken. Sometimes it had to be noted that while it was the U.S. Navy that got Osama bin Laden, the Navy men and women of the mess couldn't quite seem to get the difference between rye and wheat. Of course, they did plenty of dishes well. I was partial to the Chipotle turkey melt, once ordering it 5 days in a row. Antoinette, keen to take matters into her own hands, joined the mess board to exert influence. I pushed her to make the melt more readily available. The Navy mess brought in a new rotation of folks every few weeks or months, and there was, apparently, a very steep learning curve. Toward the end of the administration, a new man started at the window. Let's call him Gary. Gary, bless him, was the embodiment of incompetence. Orders were wrong or lost. Lines grew longer and longer. The already sinewy grilled chicken became even more stringy, prompting senior staff to file complaints through their assistants. People took to calling Gary the hot mess guy, not to be confused with the hot mess guy, who was tall, dark, and handsome, and making waves at the White House, especially within the gay staffer orbit. Things came to a head, as they so often did, with Peter Vels. It started with the premature call. The mess was famous for them. Order ready in the mess for Vels. We always took them at their word. If the professionals behind the counter said it was ready now, we thought. These guys were military, after all. Vels sprinted downstairs, excited for his lunch. He waited in a longer-than-usual line that extended about to the enclosed model of a U.S. Navy ship. He missed emails from his bosses and calls from reporters, only to learn from Gary, standing squat, squarely in the middle of the pickup window, that, "No, sorry, sir, your order's not yet ready." Vels plodded back to upper press, dragging his feet a bit. "These are the guys with the nuclear codes," he lamented, as he leapt back to his desk, answering his always ringing phone. It was the mess again. Order ready in the... Down he went, to wait in line yet again. Hungry, Velz looked at the display as he got closer to the window. It was the special of the day, glazed chicken, the good chicken, and yummy-looking fries. The display looked even better than the description in the online menu. Just the midday pick-me-up that he needed. At the window, Gary pushed the cardboard container to Velz, who inspected the contents. "There's no fries here." "Yeah, it doesn't come with fries," Gary countered. "I'm looking at the display right now, and there are fries." Gary remained stoic as Velz's blood pressure skyrocketed. "Sometimes the display is inaccurate," Gary explained. "Well, then it's wrong on the online menu, too." "I don't believe that to be true," Gary said, forcing Velz to flee upstairs. "I'll show them," he muttered to himself, falling back into his seat behind me, ignoring the ringing phone. The thing about Velz is that he admits when he's wrong. It's what he taught his interns year after year. Mistakes can be corrected, but you need to own them. No lying. Now, the flip side to that very positive trait is that when Velz is accused of being wrong when he knows he's right, well then, he must set the record straight. The printer kicked to life. As quick as he had come, he was gone again. Peter stomped back down to the mess, rushing by the line. Now, Velz is a man who treats the queue with great respect, but he had been scorned. He had tunnel vision aimed at the little opening and the little man who had screwed him out of his fries. No words were spoken. Velz didn't even need to show the menu, hot as it was off the printer. His look said it all. Teeth clenched, veins exploding through his forehead in frustration. He was met by Gary, giving him puppy dog eyes, his tail between his legs. Velz's fries were waiting for him. The folks in line offered a redeemed Peter congratulations, head nods, a spot of applause, smiles, and thumbs up. They would all get fries now if they so desired. Mission accomplished. I wondered what was going on in the Situation Room then. The Hill's 50 Most Beautiful proved that Washington, D.C. really is show business for ugly people. But that didn't keep real celebrities away. And you never knew who you would run into on the way to the mess, or who was waiting for you to exit the restroom. From Drake to the Pope, from Kendrick Lamar to Bibi Netanyahu, we had no shortage of high-profile guests at the White House. I had moved into messaging when I learned that Pope Francis was stopping by for an official visit. So unfortunately, I had no reason to be in the Oval Office during the President's meeting with His Holiness, which was a bummer for my mom, a church-going Catholic all her life. I was raised Catholic, was even lucky enough to have my beloved Uncle Wally, a priest, live with us for years while I was growing up. But I was never very religious. Praying, when I did it as a kid, was born mostly of superstition, driven by desires, to do well on a test, for instance, or in the hope that he could make Stephanie like me in fifth grade. Today, my prayers have been reduced to resuscitations born of superstition and limited to right before takeoffs at the airport. I never felt the need on Air Force One, but get me on a Delta or a United flight, and you'd better believe I'm throwing up a Hail Mary and an Our Father as we barrel down the runway. My beliefs more closely mirror my Nana's partisan rather than sacred baptism. Still, Pope Francis to me was an important breath of fresh air for the Catholic Church, which helped shape me growing up. Crucial leader on the world stage. I wanted to meet him. My strategy was simple. I would exit the upper press door toward the restroom the moment he was walking the same route to his meeting in the Oval Office. We did these sorts of laps all the time when somebody famous was in the lobby. Oprah, Bill Gates, Michael Jordan, everybody came through. But I didn't just want to see the Pope. I wanted an interaction with His Holiness. But how to make that happen? It took me a few hours, but I nailed it. I would fake a sneeze, achoo, thereby forcing the Pope to bless me. I ran the plan by friends, coworkers, bosses. I thought it was foolproof. They found it foolish. Most called it absurd, and nobody thought it would work. Desiree found it particularly distasteful and gave me 5 red zone points for even mentioning the idea. The day finally came. The Pope arrived to great fanfare. The faithful flocked to Washington. There was much pomp and circumstance throughout the city, and especially at the White House. I realized quickly there would be no opportunity for a run-in in the West Wing. His route would be different. My only chance would be on the South Lawn, where Pope Francis would speak alongside the President. The day was beautiful, marked by clear skies and a summer-like sun, unusual for so late into September. Cheers erupted from down the lawn, like an audible wave at a sports stadium, trailing the Bishop of Rome as he zipped up the South Lawn in his little black Fiat. He was moving much too quickly to hear a sneeze, so I held back, kept my powder dry. He exited his Popemobile and stepped to the dais. I was about 50 feet away. Too far. Oh well. It was foolish after all. And, I realized, likely offensive. A sin, maybe. I looked up at the sun, a little frustrated, but also awed by the proceedings. I had just been at my desk, plugging away at talking points, and now, on a brief break, I popped down to listen to the Pope and the President in the backyard of the White House. The sun caught my eyes again. I felt it coming immediately. Oh no. I heaved back and threw my head forward, releasing a thunderous, very real sneeze. The Pope didn't notice. My bosses, seated next to me, thought I was being a jerk. Desiree gave me a glare I hadn't seen since she learned I had asked Crystal about Blackish. Red zone, she hissed. Thanks. I received a number of those notes of non-thanks from the staff secretary's office, the department tasked with producing a briefing book every night for the president. The dense book is filled with dozens of tabs, memos, draft remarks, letters from the public, and briefs from offices across the White House, from the Office of Management and Administration to the National Security Council to the Communications Office. President Obama stayed up late into the night reading the book. Theirs was a thankless, meticulous task, and the staff secretary's office team is hyper-focused on the details, fonts, spacing, deadlines, and the like. That's how I knew there was nothing haphazard about the email that Ted, a well-liked, longtime member of the staff secretary's team, had sent me early one morning from his windowless basement office. Communications was regularly late with its memos, and he wondered, and probably worried, if I was responsible for submitting the president's NCAA March Madness memo to be delivered in the afternoon. I was, and I told him so, which meant I was beholden to Ted for the rest of the day. Thanks. Always ready to set a deadline, Ted lumbered through the halls with a teddy bear-like affability and an infectious, memorable laugh. All completely at odds with his online persona. His reply to my message, thanks, more of a screw you than a thank you, set the tone as I walked into upper press. Jimmy asked about my weekend. Vels gave his standard answer. He mowed the lawn, which was one of his favorite things in the world. Bobby called me Bashar, the usual. I noticed Jimmy's pencils again, and realized something. We had no pencil sharpeners in the office. I wondered if that meant he was sharpening them at home and bringing them in. The pencils were a matter of pure optics, which is where upper press thrived. Nowhere was our mandate on more vivid display than a few weeks earlier, when we sought to remind America that the president was taking very seriously his responsibility to nominate a Supreme Court justice in the wake of Antonin Scalia's sudden death. It was Dennis McDonough's idea, not to be confused with Mitt Romney's famous 2012 gaffe about potential female hires being presented to him in binders full of women. We went about building a massive binder of options. There was a lot of skepticism among senior communication staffers, who thought the whole thing was silly. Dennis stopped by upper press as folks were grappling with the best way to move forward. Vels and Desiree gave him a bit of crap about the idea. Really, Dennis? A binder? Somebody piled on about how it made a whole lot more sense to download the options to the president's iPad, which might as well have been attached to POTUS's hip. You could find him in his rare downtime enthralled, scrolling through that thing, playing the game Words with Friends or reading the New York Times. Dennis understood that the idea was a little bit silly, and he was a good sport, taking the ribbing from staffers with a smile. We weren't changing his mind, though. He sensed that his ploy would work. So he pushed back, asserting that we needed the biggest, most official presidential binder for POTUS. And we knew, too, that an iPad did nothing for us. There's no picture there. It was a be-for-what's-going-to-happen kind of a moment in upper press, which had become a West Wing aphorism for when we saw the writing on the wall. Might as well make the process as painless as possible. In this case, we knew the chief of staff had made up his mind. The binder was going to happen, and since our team's reservations were relatively mild, it was best to execute, or at the very least, to get out of the way. I was in the West Wing for 4 chiefs of staff. Bill Daley, Pete Rouse, interim, Jack Lew, and Dennis McDonough. Among varying levels of effectiveness, Dennis seemed most suited for the position. He ran a tight ship. A tall, thin man who looked, appropriately, like he didn't get enough sunlight. Dennis had an affable Minnesota twang and remembered everybody's name. From senators to janitors, from Barack to Gary from the mess. He often rode his bike to work. Crystal and I rode with him once, flanked by Secret Service. He is an impressive man, as dedicated to the cause as anybody could be, having started with Obama in 2007 and served as chief of staff for the entire second term. To his deputies, he could be intense, and some senior staff referred to his office as the Dragon's Den. But Dennis was crucial, and as good a chief of staff as a president could have. So when he pitched the binder, we knew we needed to be for what was going to happen. Binder assembled and in the hands of the president, Velez and Desiree gathered the pool photographers, videographers, and print reporters from the briefing room and set them up at the door to the colonnade, because the colonnade means serious business. They went to Brian, too, reminding him that POTUS needed to make a thing of the binder. "He's not just going to put it in his briefcase, right? We'll see it on camera," they asked Brian, which was met with a healthy eye roll, given the specific question and the general context of the night. Brian cued the president to lug his absurd binder from the Oval toward the residence, highlighting for the American people that he was thoroughly weighing his options and working after dark into the weekend. The binder, as pointless as Jimmy's pencils, was a little on the nose, even for us. But Dennis was right. The press went with it, including the photo in nearly every article on the pending Supreme Court pick, and the video accompanied every story about the deliberations. It's how the message got made. Nearly a month later, on this Tuesday in March, the president was still mired in that god-awful binder. He had yet to make a decision regarding the high court. Even so, I needed him to focus on another court and a different pick. His NCAA college basketball brackets weren't going to fill themselves out. POTUS was agonizing over the tiered, webbed printout like it was a piece of landmark legislation. I asked Brian for another update over email. Has the president made up his mind? No. "You know I'm talking about the basketball bracket and not the Supreme Court, right?" He knew. I typed thank you, and then thought better of it. I held down the delete key until only a T remained. I added the Y, pondered a moment, and let fly with just TY. My two-letter response was meant to create the sense of harried frenzy on my end. "Sure, I saw your note, but I'm too busy to spell out my response. I've got papers flying around, folders strewn about. Every letter counts to me. I'm stapling and typing, and I've got stuff to do." It was, admittedly, office optics run amok. Later, as I was about to wash my hands in the restroom across the hall, the one Brian monitored, a thud rocked the door to the bathroom. It felt like an earthquake, which we had actually dealt with years before when I was sitting in the EEOB. Apparently, and probably not surprisingly, when buildings start to shake on the White House complex, the assumption is that a bomb went off and the building is about to implode. But this I knew was different. Maybe Brian was trying to catch the culprit in the act. No, this was just somebody who had refused the courtesy of a quick double knock before pushing on the door. You see, the politics around the single-stall bathroom on the first floor of the West Wing were fraught. There was one school of thought, which I subscribed to, that said you knock no matter what. There was a second theory that you just pushed on the door. If it was locked, then it wouldn't open. No harm, no foul. Of course, not everyone remembered to lock the door, and I refused the potential for such awkwardness among coworkers. The dueling philosophies drove me nuts. I was sure that one was correct. But consensus can be hard to come by in D.C. Back in the bathroom, reeling from the thrashing at the door, I felt fortunate to have remembered to lock it. This dude's push was absurdly forceful, like he'd thrown his whole body into it. To spite whichever coworker this was, I washed my hands much longer than usual. I even used soap. This guy can wait, I thought. Hands freshly washed and thoroughly dried, I opened the door and looked up, and then kept looking up, and looked up some more, craning my neck until the forceful attempt on the door made a whole lot more sense. It was Shaq. He said something, but I couldn't make it out. His voice was too deep to register. I walked away stunned. I was ready to recount the run-in as I returned to upper press, but found a note waiting for me in my inbox, from Jimmy. Staff Sec was asking about the NCAA memo again. I was annoyed, but knew better than to reply to Jimmy with anything other than a thank you. Moments later, Brian rushed to my desk. I thought maybe he had the same hunch I did about Shaquille O'Neal, but his visit was about something different. "You know about college basketball, right?" "Yeah," I said. realizing I hadn't remotely kept up with the season and likely couldn't even name the top four seeds. The president needs to see you. Mr. President, Pat knows what's going on. With that, I was thrust into the Oval Office, the floor creaking as I stepped in. The president was seated, head down, at the Resolute desk across the room, which felt like a mile away, with no one else around and no clue what I was doing or why I was approaching the leader of the free world, wholly unprepared. Pete Souza, who was always there to catch a photo, wasn't even around. Normally, after you go into the Oval Office, you wait a few days and then sheepishly email the White House photo office. Hey there, any chance Pete snagged a photo when I was in the Oval? If there were a way over email to purposely bump into someone and then just so happen to ask for a favor, that's what these awkward notes would amount to. Still, it would be worth it. Usually, you would receive a photograph that would make your mom cry. With Pete absent, I wondered if this Oval Office visit even counted. As I approached, I noticed that there was just one piece of paper on the president's grand desk, occupying his time and energy. President Obama often recounted that if something reached his desk, then it had to be a very difficult decision, because if it were simple, somebody would have solved it long before it made its way to the Oval Office. And his desk, the Resolute desk, a gift from Queen Victoria to President Rutherford Hayes, and used by many subsequent presidents, was worthy of the business that got done on it. So what was this lone sheet of paper dominating the chief executive's attention in this moment? It was the college basketball bracket we had printed for him. I suppose some of the picks were difficult, but I suspect some of the 16 versus 1 seeds could have been delegated to a cabinet secretary. He looked up at me. Hey brother, so for this NCAA thing. Oh shit, he called me brother. That's cool. Last year, did we run through the Sweet 16 or the Elite 8 on TV? Oh shit, I have no clue. I barely know what you're talking about. I could ask him a follow-up, but this seems a pretty simple either-or proposition that I was evidently brought in specifically to answer. I could tell him I'd double-check. But isn't that what I was supposed to have done already? 16. Oh shit, I just lied to the president. I said it with total confidence. A bald-faced lie to the president of the United States in his own office. I rationalized that I didn't know I was wrong, I just didn't know if I was right either. And I could check and confirm the moment I got out of there. It's not that I was purposely pushing false information. I was just leaving out that I wasn't actually sure the answer was 16, and that I had no real evidence for the guess in the first place. It was a lie of omission by commission, if that's a thing. It's not. Jesus, I thought to myself. Considering I was basically baptized a Democrat, a lie to Barack Obama has to be worse than a lie to the Pope. The president, oblivious to my internal debate, made a decision. Got it. Well, I just want to do 8 this time. That way we can talk more about the actual teams rather than spend all that time filling the thing out on air. That makes total sense, sir, I said, not knowing if this was a problem for ESPN in any way, shape, or form. Out of the corner of my eye, I noticed that Pete had crept in, capturing my presidential lie for posterity. I'm sure they'll be all for that, I told the president. As I thanked him and turned to leave, President Obama looked up from his bracket once more. Thanks, he said. I suspect with a period. Chapter 6. Disaster Casual. Ubuntu is very difficult to render into a Western language. It speaks of the very essence of being human. Desmond Tutu. Put yourself in his shoes. Imagine, you've just arrived in Africa, your own father's homeland. Because this is one of your most meaningful overseas visits, you're traveling with your mother-in-law, one of your daughters, and your wife, herself the descendant of slaves. You are touring Gori Island, the infamous haunting marker of the transatlantic slave trade off the coast of Dakar, Senegal. You conclude your visit to the both literally and figuratively dark Maison des Esclaves, the House of Slaves. You move toward a small doorway bathed in light. You step out of this haunting memorial and are instantly at the vantage point of so many Africans who, for hundreds of years, took in that very view as they were forced to board boats embarking for the New World. Out of this door of no return, your children's ancestors could have been forced to North America to live and die as slaves. Some of those men and women who exited the portal might even have gone on to help build your family's current home. You are America's first black president. If ever there was a place to consider the past, the future, and where we stand now than this place, where humanity took root and racism took hold, is it. Out on this ledge, overlooking the Atlantic, you're eyeing the vast blue expanse and contemplating these enslaved men's and women's journeys.